1 Samuel 19, please. If I can have some men help me, I would very much appreciate that. Let's see here. Sir, thank you. Thank you, sir. First Samuel 19. Josh, you have a job. Amy took care of the job. I don't know how those doors get open, but they're always open. 1 Samuel 19. All right, everybody has some notes? I was thinking about entitling this sermon tonight, Worry, or Frenchie's Other Name. By the way, you do recognize, I want to ask you all a question. Do you recognize when people are worry people? We're not really with it quite yet. Let's all stand. Got some already asleep and we haven't even begun. Do you recognize when people have problems with worry, yes or no? My guess is probably not, because we camouflage worry through various means. Yes? Tonight's sermon is really all about worry, though I'm never going to mention the word after I get done right now. It's all about worry, because it's about David. David has already escaped Saul a time or two, but what's going to happen in the future? And by the way, this will be a repeated theme. This will be a repeated theme after God delivers David in a cave, after God delivers David in when he slips into an entrenchment with Saul is there. In chapter 27, the last encounter with David, he's still slipping off and trying to figure out, how am I going to be alive tomorrow? If you read the first couple of verses of chapter 27, don't do it right now. You'll find out David finally gives into his worry. He gives into his worry twice. He goes and fights for the Philistines. Let me ask you again, do you have a problem with worry? We're going to read one total verse, and then we're going to pray. Verse 1. Saul spake to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants, that they should kill David. That's the marching orders of the king. Now, let's ask the question, how are you feeling about tomorrow? The marching orders are, if you see David, kill him. The rest of the chapter is about God saving David, but really, as we move forward, this is going to keep coming up. Let's look at chapter 27. I recognize some might not have read that recently. You know, Pastor Warren has spoken on some subjects too often. I haven't spoken on it much in the last couple of years, but for a period of about 2 years, I spoke on this subject more than any other subject combined. But yet, I still find people that do not recognize, look at me, they talk to themselves. And until you recognize you talk to yourself and you can get control of the conversation that's going on in your head right now, you don't go very far in your life. Look at chapter 27, verse 1. And David said where? This is the conversation that you have with yourself. I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape into the land of the Philistines, and Saul shall despair of me to seek me any more in any coast of Israel. So shall I escape out of his hand. That's the backdrop of chapter 19. David, again, has a death sentence on his head. And what's going to happen? How does God save or rescue David during this time? Let's pray, please. Father, I ask your blessings tonight on this time. I recognize for whatever reason we're very light today all day. The weather's gloomy. Some of us are already sleeping even before we stand to read the scripture. But Lord, help me tonight not to worry about the sleepyheads, because we have some important things to think about life. Because most of us will probably be here tomorrow. What's going to happen? How are we going to make it? Help us tonight to understand how you least saved David at three different times and how you might work in our own lives. This we ask in Christ's name. Amen. You may be seated. In your notes, I'm not going to make comments on this other than just in general. The future grips all of us to some degree. Some people attempt to control it. They spend a great deal of time doing things in order to control the future. By the way, that's what worry by its very nature is. Some people fear it. There's this always ongoing fear of the future and what might happen. I talked to a person, and I've talked to this person a half a dozen times, and in a half a dozen times, this person keeps telling me when they're getting older, they're going to have Alzheimer's. And I ask them, how do you know this? And they don't have an answer. It's just a nagging fear that they're going to have Alzheimer's. Some folks have Alzheimer's already. How about this one? Some ignore it. And instead of dealing with anything, maybe they just drown it. Meaning, I think you know what that means, don't you? Instead of dealing with a life and dealing with here I am, 18, 22, 28, 34, 38, 42, it's just, let me take another drink, and if I drink enough, maybe the future goes away and everything gets better. That works. Some people are nagged by it. It's a nagging thing, and I think for most of us, there is a sense of the unknown. You never know what kind of news you're going to get. There's a sense of uncertainty. It's something that's right out of sight. You can't quite get your hand around it, and you know something could go wrong. Well, 1 Samuel 19:1 is the bad news. When you wake up on Monday morning, you find out that Saul has put a death sentence on your life, and he has told everybody that they should kill you, or David in this case. So what is God going to do? I wish I could stand before you. I am not as nervous as some of you. I'm not a control freak, and control is all about the future. I'm assuming you know, I'm not a drinker. You say, why? I don't have enough money to drink. Besides that, Tim won't go drinking with me. So who am I going to drink with? I don't have some of these problems, but all of us recognize right out there in the future, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, and any number of things can go wrong. My mother-in-law, my wife's mother, this is not a criticism of her, this is a fact, is 90 years old, which means I met her nearly 40 years ago. 40 years ago, because of her family's medical history, she was dying. Because everybody in her family died at a very young age. When her older sister lived to be 70, nobody in her whole family had ever made 70, even close. And here's her older sister making 70. Jenny's mom is younger. And when she made 70 and broke that, no one had ever done it. And here she is 90. I'm not mad at her. She was dying for 40 years. Now, have I got your attention? This is something that we can't figure out how to get a handle on. I'm not necessarily the best person at this. 1977. I see Haley back there. Haley, you were how old in 1977? In June of 1977, my older sister went into the hospital to have her fourth child. She had three children, and she was pregnant with number four, and from the first week of number four, she was sick the entire pregnancy. This was before my wife and I met, before I came here. She had been sick, my older sister. Finally, in June of 1977, she delivers her fourth child. She has a fifth one after this. Her fourth child, when he is born, he is sick and almost dead at birth. He has a problem with his liver. And I don't know all the medical background because I'm getting it third and fourth handed through non-medical people, but I believe he did not have the means, common bile ducts, that drain the liver, and therefore his liver had backed up all the poisons in the liver and had destroyed 90% of his liver at birth. So I don't know how big his liver was at birth, but we'll say it was this big. He just had a sliver. This is really good. That was not intentional. A sliver of his liver that still functioned at birth, 10%. By the way, they did surgeries, I think 3 surgeries before he came home. And the doctor said he will never live. He had every symptom of a last end-stage drunk. Do you know what a drunk looks like when they get old? They don't have a beer belly. They have a belly down here where their liver gets big. They have a problem because the blood doesn't flow through the liver. He didn't have a liver for the blood to flow through. So a lot of times we would see this in the emergency room. You have some veins in your esophagus that will rupture, and you will literally shoot blood all over the place. When Brian was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 years old, he would be in the emergency room 2 or 3 or 4 times a year, vomiting blood. Do you know how they solved the problem? It's like taking a branding iron. They stick it down your throat and they singe that shut. Look at me. I said he looked and acted like an old drunk. That was Brian. Now, for all of you, Haley, you're so young, and Shelby, you're no better. I'm assuming you all know what happened from 1981 to about 1986 in medicine in America in the blood supply. That's when he's getting these blood transfusions. We used to call it human T lymphocyte virus number 3. Now they call it AIDS. Brian is getting gallons of blood. But we didn't know there was even a problem early on. Finally, at age 9, a hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a children's hospital, has a place where they're starting to do liver transplants. Success in that year, 1986, 9 years later, success was this. You went home from the hospital. Not 1 year, not 3 years, not 5 years. No, you got to go home. Brian went into the hospital. Jenny remembers. I remember it. I was in Bible college at the time. Goes into the hospital. He has a liver transplant, and the first liver transplant doesn't work. In those days, they cost $250,000 for a liver transplant. So put yourself in Brian's shoes. Brian's looking at his mother, begging his mother not to do another liver transplant, to let him die. And he's 9. My sister's husband said, just let him die. My sister wouldn't. But the reason I'm telling you the story is not my sister only. I remember talking to my mother, and my mother said, I know God is going to heal Brian. Now, you can have your religion. You can talk religion. But you understand, first of all, my mother doesn't say that stuff much. And second of all, no one had ever come home from a liver transplant. A month after he'd been in the hospital, he got liver transplant number 2, and he came home. He had a bag of drugs. To this day, Brian grew to about, 5'1", 5'2", maybe. He didn't grow properly, but he survived. He came home. He started to grow in other ways, intellectually, etc. It stunted his height, and he never got AIDS. But he did get hepatitis C. Atong, does hepatitis C kill you? Of course. So he gets hepatitis C. When he got hepatitis C, at that time there was no way of treating hepatitis C. My mother again said, she told me this recently, I'm sure that God will heal Brian. I'm thinking, Mom, hepatitis C is a... Now, by the way, do you all know this? Atong, you know this. You ought to know this. There's a cure for it now. Problem is, he wasn't healthy enough for the cure. Now, this is the miracle. That little boy that was born in 1976, is still alive. He's 40 years old. His hepatitis C, without the treatment, because he can't take the treatment. My sister said he hasn't done this well in a decade. He has two children. Some of you won't understand this. I'm not going to get into the details. They don't have hepatitis C. Neither does his wife. So I want to say this to all of you. I've seen simple Christians have more faith than a lot of people trying to arrange their little ducks to get them all in a row and worry about the future. And God is this big and we're this big. So I know this. God does hear and answer prayer. Well, let's look at the text one more time. How does God save David? It says in verse 1, "And Saul spake to Jonathan his son and all his servants that they should kill David." So I ask the question, so how will God continue to save David? And some of this is even, in some ways, pieces of this apply to my nephew, Brian, which is nearly 40 years old. He's 39 plus. Number one, God saves through the intervention of a friend. This is probably the most normal way God saves people. David was under a threat of death, but David had a friend named Jonathan that came alongside, intervened for him. So verse 2 says, "And Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father, seeketh to kill thee now. Therefore, I pray thee, take heed to thyself until the morning, and abide in a secret place and hide thyself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where thou art, and I will commune with my father of thee. And what I see, that I will tell thee." So verse 4, that's just background. Jonathan does some things for his friend. But then in verse 4, "Jonathan spake good of David unto his Saul, his father." Was this a wise move? Saul was irrational. He would try to kill Jonathan too. But this is what a friend did. He intervened. He said to his dad, "Let not the king sin against his servant, against David, because he hath not sinned against thee, and because his works have been to thee word very good. For he did put his life in his hand, and he slew the Philistine. And the Lord wrought a great salvation for all of Israel. Thou sawest it and didst rejoice. Wherefore then wilt thou sin against innocent blood to slay David without a cause?" So we find right up front, we find this guy named David being, his friend interceding for him and intervening for him to protect him. So one of the ways that God saved David was through his friend. It makes good sense to me. God uses means. God uses close, friendly means. God uses people that we love and who love us. Look at verse 6. It's kind of beautiful. It says, "And Saul hearkened unto the voice of Jonathan." Hearken is just another word for he listened and did something about it. He actually listened to what Jonathan said, and he swear, as the Lord liveth, he shall not be slain. And verse 7 says, "And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan showed him all those things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as in times past." Very quickly, I'll just give you some basic ideas. First of all, Jonathan was a friend who spoke up. He spoke up, and that's not an easy thing to do in these circumstances. Secondly, he spoke truth. There was no lying. David was doing nothing to harm Saul. David was an honorable man, or young man in this case. So he spoke the truth. Next, who spoke but first protected David. He pulled David aside first and protected him so he wouldn't be killed. Next, he spoke as a friend and with his own authority as the king's son. So he comes as a friend of David, but with his own authority as an important person. And lastly, he's someone who spoke persuasively. In your notes, I say this: in the normal state of things, this is how God does business. He uses, and you tell me the next word, he uses means. Now, I'm going to tell you all of you in this room, when I was a young man in Bible college, it's been a long time, we used to have testimony times. And we'd have students get up and say, "I needed $1,000 to stay in school, and So I came to the school and went to the office and somebody had paid my school bill. Or I went out to my mailbox and there was a check in the mailbox. And I'd hear these stories and I'd be out in the audience thinking, God has never done that for me. And I'd need something and I'd pray. And every time I prayed, God would give me overtime. And I didn't want overtime. I wanted a miracle. I wanted God just to drop, you know, somehow drop some money in my pocket. I wanted it to come through, you know, I don't know. Can you text money? I don't know. But I wanted it to come here quickly. And God would say, yeah, okay, you need some money. Here's an extra night. You need some money. Here's an extra weekend day. You need some money. You can work two extra. Oh, I hate that. Wait a minute. Please look at me. I'm not trying to be cute. Until I realized, normally God uses the means closest to us. Listen, my nephew is alive today. Yes. Is that a miracle? I think so. But may I say this? There was a lot of doctors, nurses, and other people working. God uses, he used Jonathan. Jonathan was a person right next door, and God used that. And look, if you think God is going to somehow just bail you out and it's going to be this grand Red Sea miracle where the Red Sea parts and you walk between, good luck. Most of the time, there's not going to be any parting of the Red Sea. You've heard the joke. It's a dumb joke, but I like it. Guy was in a flood on the Mississippi. You've heard the dumb joke. Probably Jim probably does this kind of thing. The guy was in the flood on the Mississippi and out comes a boat. The boat comes along to pick him up, to rescue him. And the guy says, no, I want God to deliver me. I'm not getting in that boat. So the boat guy goes on. A little bit later, another guy comes by. This guy comes by in a helicopter. The guy says, no, I'm waiting for God to deliver me. Four or five times later, the guy finally drowns and wakes up in heaven and says, Lord, why didn't you save me? And he says, don't you understand? You know, it was the boat, it was the helicopter, are you a bonehead? And the answer is, you say, I want God to do something in my life, folks. Most of the time, God uses normal stuff. You have a friend named Jonathan. You know somebody, or you know someone that knows somebody, and God organizes these matters. That's the normal way God works. Honestly, I came to realize most of the time those testimonies weren't telling the truth. Most of those testimonies where God miraculously puts money in somebody's box, yeah, their parents were sending the money. And guess how their parents got that money? They were working, yes. Number two, God saves through the intervention of a friend and he saves through the deception of a wife. I don't know what to say about this, friend. This is a little different. Verse 8, and there was war again, and David went out and fought with the Philistines and slew them with a great slaughter, and they fled before him. And by the way, when you get to the end of that verse, what's your first thought? Wonderful. But what got David in trouble the first time? Yeah, the last thing Saul liked was David having success. So here's David out there leading the army, and guess what? Saul's back there seething because God is blessing David. So verse 9 says, and the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul, and as he sat in the house with his javelin in his hand, and David played with his hand, and Saul sought to smite David even to the wall with a javelin, but he slipped away out of Saul's presence. And he smote the javelin into the wall, and David fled and escaped that night. This is kind of the transition in the story to the second way God's going to deliver David. The first way through the intervention of his friend, and now he's moving to the second time to the deception of his wife. In your notes, I'm assuming everybody knows this. Life never remains the same. It's the hardest thing I've ever experienced as a pastor. Folks, the only thing, if you ask me, the only thing, there's a couple things I don't like. I don't like people who don't grow. I don't like to sit down in Sunday school and have people look at me like, assurance of salvation? Why should I know any of those verses? But the hardest thing is, nothing ever remains the same. 10 years from now, look at me. 10 years from now, there'll be people in this room in heaven Yes? The chances are real good there'll be people in this room in heaven that are here tonight. Listen, Frenchie's 270 years old. The only difference is we're not so sure about the heaven, but anyhow. In your notes, life never remains the same. Life is never stable. Danger always returns. I'll come back to the one above that. Life never remains the same. Life is never stable. The next one's easy. Saul is always Saul. Friend, God always leaves you with a Saul. There's always a Saul someplace. Danger always returns, and God continues to save. Next page, please. God saves, in this case, through a wife. Frenchie saves through, not save through. Frenchie proofed it, but didn't do a good job. Saves through a wife. But actually, everyone look at me. Do you know how he saved? Do you know how God saved David? Through the lies of the wife. And by the way, the whole story is a lie. And it's a worse lie than some of you recognize. And when you get done with this tonight, you're going to have to ask yourself a question. And it's not an easy question. There's a Hebrew in this thing. I know none of you read Hebrew, but you got to get the one word. Because there's an ugly thing here. Well, let's read this together. You say, you mean God uses people's lies to... God uses lots of stuff. God used animals. Jesus said, if my disciples don't say something, these stones are going to have to cry out. God can use anything, friend, for his purposes. Verse 11, Saul also sent messengers unto David's house to watch him and to slay him or murder him in the morning. And Michal, that was his wife, one of them early, David's wife told him, saying, if thou save not thy life tonight, tomorrow thou shalt be slain. So Michal let David down through a window. So far, so good, correct? All Michael's done so far is open the window, let David down through some kind of conveyance, I don't know, rope or whatever. Maybe she, you know, she went into her bathroom and she had those things that grow on the shower curtains. She tied them all together and he came down on those. I'm not sure what it was, but somehow she got him down. Everything's good so far. It says, Michal let David down through a window and he went and fled and escaped. And then it says, and Michal took a teraphim. What in the world is an idol doing in her house? I asked you a question. She just have it, it was just sitting over the corner just in case. You know, I might need to lie to my dad in the future, so I got the idol sitting in the corner. I didn't know what else to do with it. By the way, this is not a good story. She has an idol, a teraphim, in her house. Just happened to have it. Oh, my goodness. It's like you get pulled over by the police, you know, and you have a bag of something sitting over, and it's like, well, yeah, not mine. It grew. It grew right in my floor of my car. Okay, we continue. So it says, and Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair for his bolster, the pillow, and covered it with a cloth. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, he is sick. So far, the first part was pretty good, letting him down through the window. The second part, I don't know, you know, if I went to your house, would I find a small idol? That's the question. And then she lies to her dad. Is it okay to lie to your dad? Let me ask you that question. Is it okay to lie to somebody? Now, if you're not going to be here Wednesday night, don't worry about this, but Wednesday night we're going to talk about this. Is it okay to deceive people? Some people don't have a problem lying about anything. There are people in this church that are liars. It's hard to get the truth out of them. I didn't say they were believers. I said they come here. They lie pretty much continual. And no, I don't respect that. But is it okay to deceive somebody? So we go back to the story. You're in Germany, and you're hiding a Jewish person in your house. Is it okay to deceive people? Yeah, these are hard questions, aren't you? Well, she deceives her father. We continue. And then it goes on to say, let's see, in verse 15 it says, and Saul, oh, wait a minute, she says in verse 14, Saul sent messengers to take David, and she said he is sick. He was not sick, by the way. Verse 15, and Saul sent the messengers again to see David, saying, bring him up to me in the bed that I may slay him. And when the messengers were come in, behold, there was an image in the bed with a pillow of goat's hair for the bolster or the pillow. And Saul said unto Michal, why hast thou deceived me? He knew exactly what she had done and sent away mine enemy that he is escaped. So we have an idol. We have the deception which Saul read correctly. And Michal answered Saul, he said unto me, let me go. Why should I kill thee? We have what? Another lie. Yet through this story, David is rescued. Now, friends, I'm not recommending that your wife lies for you or anybody else. I'm just simply saying God uses means. Sometimes you're like, how did you get from point A to point B, and how did this all work out? And the answer is nobody knows, but somehow God is bigger than all of our stupid. Well, the next verse is where we end up. So David fled. It was part of what God used for David to survive. I'm going to give you these verses because in your own mind and heart, you will have to determine what God can use. So let's ask a question before we go further. If Donald Trump becomes the president, God forbid, yes? Or if Hillary the witch Clinton becomes the president, God forbid. Is God limited? That's the question we have to ask. Because there's not a person in this room, if you have brains, and many of you do, that can look at either candidate and say, yes! Here's what you look at and you go, actually you say, wait a minute, I need to go vomit. What does God use? What's God going to use? Well, God used the deception of David's wife. Psalm 76:10, surely the wrath of man shall praise thee. Not the good that man does, even his evil. The remainder of wrath shall thou restrain. Ephesians 1:11, in whom also we have obtained an inheritance in Christ, being predestinated according to the purpose of him, this talking about God, who worketh all things after the counsel of his own will. In some way, God uses things. It's like, how would God use that? And I'm not saying to do that to find out how God uses it. I'm saying God does use things. Somehow, some way. Acts 4:27, to bring his son to the cross. It says, for of a truth, against thy holy child Jesus, whom thou hast anointed, both Herod Antipas, and Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, and the appointed, whatever you call Herod, of the northern parts, Galilee and north, with the Gentiles, meaning some Roman soldiers, and the people of Israel were gathered together. They all got together to crucify Christ. But as Peter says, for to do whatsoever thy hand and thy counsel determined before to be done. Somehow God used the sinfulness of all of these people for his purposes. And God was sovereign, and they were responsible. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. Everyone look at me, and we're almost done. The last section I have for Chris Winders. This is 100% for you, Chris. You say, why? Because it has his son's name in it. And I thought it would be, it doesn't exactly have his name, but it has the plural form of his name. That works for you. What is the word for messenger in the Bible, in the Old Testament? Yes, it's malach. If it's my messenger, it's malachi. If it's plural, it's malachim. Messenger in the Bible is the word used, look up here, for angel and for messenger, because an angel is just an angelic or supernatural messenger, and human messengers. By the way, in the New Testament, it's angelos. An angelos is a messenger. You have to determine from the context, is it one from heaven or is it just a human messenger? Six or so times in the New Testament, it's very obvious it's just a human messenger. In this passage, we have human messengers, but that is not the humor of the passage. I thought about trying to illustrate this. I don't know if I can for sure. Let me see. How many people do I need? Let's see. Cliffy, can I borrow you? Bring your stuff with you because you'll just stay right up here. Cliffy, I'll borrow you. Atong, can I borrow you? Yes? I need three groups. Pastor Kwok, can I borrow you? That's three. And who wants to be Saul? Louis Heras. Thank you, Louis. Come up here. He was El Diablo this morning in Sunday school. You got to sit over here, Tim. Tim, you're over here. And Louis, you come over here, please. You three guys just stand right over here. There is something hilarious in this text. This text is so funny. It's not as obvious in English, so I stuck Hebrew in there. Not that you need to read it. Because look at me. It's doing this. It's winking at you. There's a third way God delivers David. The first way makes sense. Jonathan. The second way, you're a little antsy because it's like lying. You teach your kids not to lie, don't you? But somehow God used the lying. Yes, but don't try lying to see how it works. That's called stupid. Okay, don't do that. The last one, God decides to subvert Saul's purposes. Saul's had enough. Jonathan won't do the job. Michael won't do the job. He's going to do the job. He finds out what? He finds out David is over in a certain location. Read with me in verse 18. So David fled and escaped and came to Samuel in Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Naioth. It's hard to know if this is a place or it might be a descriptive of something else. In verse 19, and it was told Saul, saying, behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah. And David sent Malachim. There you go. The plural of your son. Just have one Malachi, though. You don't want two. One's enough. So Saul sent some messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying and Samuel standing at appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul. Again, you have odd, it's Hebrew, but it's the messenger of Shaul. And here's the Hebrew phrase. Look here. Here's the first guy. He sends some messengers. He's had enough of this. Jonathan's tricked him. Michael's tricked him, so I'm going to send some of my men. He sends them, and the prophets are doing their business, and God subverts and mocks all of them. So while the prophets are prophesying, and Samuel's doing whatever he's doing in the leadership, the Spirit of God comes on, look at me, these unsaved men, and all of a sudden, they're prophets too. And they can't do what they came there to do. So look at the text. It keeps adding up on this. It says in verse 20, and Saul sent messengers to take David, and when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as appointed over them, the Spirit of God was upon the messengers of Saul, and they also, Gam Hama, they also prophesied. So here's the first group of messengers. They didn't do the job. Saul's infuriated. Send another group. Look at this. Verse 21. And when it was told Saul, he sent, yes, you got the hint, Malachim, another group of these guys. And guess what they did? The same Hebrew words. They again. They came there to get him. They couldn't get him either because they lost control of themselves. God is taking the foolishness of Saul and subverting it to his own purpose. And this is a true miracle. So there's one group of messengers. There's a second group of messengers. Saul's about to pull out whatever hair he has left. He's going to send a third group of messengers. Well, how'd that work? And Saul sent Malachim again the third time. And Gam Hayah, they also prophesied. Folks, he sent this group and they prophesied. He sent this group and they prophesied. He sent this group and they prophesied. God is subverting the foolishness of wicked men. Look at me. Not every time. Oh, I wish we had the way to pray. And when we had the Supreme Court recently deciding to upend the Constitution, that God would have subverted their foolishness. For some reason, God doesn't always do this, but in this case, he subverted the first group of messengers, the second group of messengers, the third group of messengers, and they end up, instead of killing David or capturing David, they end up being a prophet. They join the Baptist. Well, we continue. It gets funnier. Well, it is to me anyhow. Verse 22. It uses the same phrase again, except with the word he. Then went Gom, who? He also to Ramah, and came to a great wall that is in Sekhu, and he asked, saying, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they be at Naoth in Ramah. And he went thither to Naoth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God was, what? He's already subverted this group and this group and this group. So Saul says, I'm going to get him. And God says, no, you're not. See, the humor is, you're not getting the humor. Because the funny part is, Saul was a pagan. And God is making him to look like a non-pagan. Like God is revealing truth through him. So here's pagan. Boy, this is a good example right here, isn't it? Isn't this a good example? Here, this guy was El Diablo this morning, and he's Saul tonight. And guess what God did to Saul? God subverted a tyrant. He turned the tyrant upside down and made fun of everybody. Can our God do that? Yes or no? Yes. Now, by the way, don't count. How does God normally work? Through your friends, through the normal processes. Sometimes he takes somebody's sin and deception like Michael, and sometimes he just wants to make fun of tyrants. So he makes fun of this group, he makes fun of this group, he makes fun of this group, and finally, when the big shot comes, he makes fun of that one. Well, let's continue reading to the end of this, would you please? The Spirit of God was upon him also. It keeps repeating that word also, the Hebrew word gom. And went and prophesied until he came to Naoth to Ramah. And he stripped off his clothes also. Again, using the same phraseology. And prophesied before Samuel in like manner. Again, the same phrase, gom who? He also did this. And he lay down naked all that day. I mean, just to prove that God was doing this, God, it was almost like knocked him out miraculously. Wherefore they say, and by the way, they're not saying, isn't it nice that Saul got saved? They're saying, did you know what happened to Saul? He was trying to kill David. Do you know what God did? And can I tell you this? Some of us, there's no need to talk to people about the future. The people that are going to worry because they think that's religious. The people that have to control everything, and if their meal isn't on at 6 p.m., they're yelling, they're going to play their games. But for the rest of us, we'll rest and trust a sovereign God. Look at me. Who can use our friends? Who can use deception? And once in a while, can make fun of the God-haters. He can save any way he desires. And our trust is in the Lord. Wait a minute. Not in the means. I can't always trust that God's going to make fun of Saul. I can't always trust that God's going to take this group of messengers, and this group of messengers. But I can trust wherever I go into the future, he shall preserve me unto his heavenly kingdom. You say, how many times does God do this? Until the last time when you step on the other side. That's how long he does it. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word tonight. Thank you.